Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, this is Bruce Norris. Thank you for joining us. Today we have two guests with us. Paul Earnhardt, he is a senior founding principal of Lee & Associates, and one of his team partners, Eric Hernandez, senior vice president. Both of them I have had the privilege of going to lunch with and discussing the commercial real estate world. Welcome, both of you, to our show.
Yep, thank you, Bruce.
Hi, Bruce. Thank you.
Paul, first question to you. There's a lot of types of real estate that fall under the commercial umbrella. Which of those categories do you specialize in?
Principally industrial.
Industrial, okay. Now, you're also familiar with, let's say, the professional office space?
Yes, we follow that market. Our office definitely has people that specialize in that component of the market. But myself and Eric are principally focused on the industrial side.
Okay. Looking back, we know that residential real estate peaked somewhere around 2006, the end of 2006. What about commercial real estate? I think it's obviously peaked. Do we know when that peak was?
I would say that it peaked in a similar time frame, but the peak had a little more echo effect to it that carried over until July of 07.
Okay. And July of 07, what did all of a sudden, what happened to make you realize, okay, we've now changed?
You know, there was a couple of large transactions where the capital partners were trying to get out of them.
Okay.
Right before the credit crunch that occurred in August of that year. And so we started seeing some of the players trying to back out of deals, and or deals were starting to get a lot more scrutiny all of a sudden, and I mean like all of a sudden, like, you know, in a 2-week time frame. And that's when we kind of figured, well, the attitudes have changed. It's going to be a different ball game.
Eric, the financing for the residential real estate in 2004 and 2006 really helped prices get to a very absurd level. Did commercial real estate have its own version of stated income financing?
Well, Lehman Brothers actually was doing commercial loans as well. Paul, was it under Aurora, or was it under another name, I think, that they, you know, originated and sold those loans to? But I don't think overall we had the same, you know, free money lending on the commercial side on say, owner-user sales. But on the investment side, Paul, I mean, development?
I
think the principal difference, Bruce, is that our version of it would have been not just a stated income component, but they were willing to finance buildings based on sale comps as opposed to income streams.
Right.
Okay.
And the deals, we didn't see income stream analysis at the end of the day. At the end of the day, what we saw was show us the building sale comps, and if the building sale comps worked, the deal worked. And that, of course, has gone 180 now. Everything's being done again on an income basis.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a day you looked at yourself and the prices that people were paying you went, okay, this cannot continue?
Yeah, it was about a year and a half before that.
Okay. But, of course, it went beyond reason then.
Well, you know, for us, we're kind of bread and butter guys, and we always kind of analyze everything in a pre-tax monthly cash flow alternative model. So if a tenant or if a company is going to go into some space and it's a buy versus lease decision, what is the alternative lease rate from a pre-tax cash flow standpoint? And typically that runs, the people are willing to pay a premium of 110 to maybe 120% because there's some after-tax benefits, but we were seeing premiums up in the 135-140% range, and that's when we were scratching our heads.
Okay. Who was the typical buyer of a commercial property in 2004 through, say, 2006?
The of course, in our market, in the Inland Empire, there's a huge amount of entrepreneurial businesses that are both domestic and foreign. We had a large percentage of buyers that were Asian buyers, Chinese, Taiwanese, and Hong Kong. We had a lot of domestic buyers, and most of them were filling the buildings with consumer goods or consumer type services, or building and trade, you know, building construction type services.
Is that now a problem?
It's not. It has slowed down substantially. The market has receded back to the west, the east end, what we call the east end, which in would be the 215 corridor, San Bernardino. Those areas have slowed much more markedly than say west of the 15. But it's clearly the pace is down, and our office is down year over year. We'll be down probably 50-60%. What's really disappeared most dramatically is there is no new development.
Okay. Has the foreign investor gone home as well?
No, they haven't left totally, but they are very, very, very slow and cautious now. The transaction volume is dropped substantially. We're still selling buildings, but at a very slow rate.
Okay. Eric, when people finance these purchases, were there deep pockets involved usually, where there was a tremendous amount of cash involved, or maybe even free and clear, or were they leveraged?
Well, it depends on the size of the transaction. If they were companies buying buildings that were going to occupy them themselves,
yes,
that would typically fall under what we would call owner-user financing. Typically, in that case, the buyer would put 10% down and would finance the other 90% of the purchase price.
And that would be in a first, there's a lender that would have done a first trust deed at 90%?
There's a first trust deed at 50% and then a 40% second trust deed that is guaranteed by the SBA, by the Small Business Administration.
Okay, and that was a reasonable interest rate then, I would think.
Typically, yeah.
Okay. Is that program still out there?
It is. In fact, a lot of the regional community banks and even some of the nationals like Wells Fargo and Bank of America are still very active in that lending space. You know, and I think in their minds, they're doing 50% loan-to-value, right?
Yeah, not a big risk.
Yeah, so the other 40% is guaranteed by the SBA. So, you know, that's something that they'd like to lend all day on as long as it, you know, the buyer qualifies under their underwriting criteria.
Does that mean the SBA will soon be in line for a bailout?
I haven't looked at their balance sheet. I don't know.
It would seem like that might be in line. I'm not sure.
We have seen, Bruce, art values have deteriorated probably 15% from what we would have seen as maybe the peak in the market.
Mm-hmm.
There are some one-off situations occurring where that decline has even been greater, where guys are down to their last two or three buildings, their construction loans due, they can't get replacement financing, and they're letting them go.
Just to give you a little information in regards to residential, I mean, the residential market is just been crushed in some areas. We buy a fair amount of properties. We bought 12 houses last month. Our average purchase price was the lender getting 28% of what they were owed.
Wow.
That was our average. Just for fun, I went on to the MLS this morning, and there was a property that had sold for $312,000 at the peak of the market, and it was listed for
$48,000. Wow. Was listed for... Now, was that a house that needed a lot of repair?
Sure.
Like an abandoned house, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, the typical repair. It's not missing wiring or plumbing. It's just that's the number.
Look, yeah. The reality of it is the lot would have sold more than...
Of course. Oh, absolutely. The lot would... We're buying houses now for lot value.
We haven't seen that kind of carnage. We do expect some pretty rough road over the next 18 to 24 months. What is happening in our market is rents have dropped, and as rents drop, values drop, and as values drop, financing in this market gets to be impossible for some.
Well, let's talk about the financing, because I really thought that had changed. And Eric, you just described a situation where that seems still like very feasible financing. So what has changed in the financing of commercial real estate from the peak of the market to now?
Well, one of the things you have to be careful of, Bruce, is that the SBA financing is only good up to about $3 million right now, maybe a little more. Anything over $3 million has to go conventional financing, right?
Okay.
Anything under $3 million has a shot at an SBA deal. What is happening with the SBA is they are more conservatively underwriting the deals as well in terms of debt coverage ratio. They're paying more attention to the DCR as opposed to pure sale comps now.
And what's DCR?
Debt coverage ratio is the amount of times that the rent has to equal the payment. So let's say the payment's $1,000. The lender today would like to see $1,250 in true rental potential income.
Okay, well, that's not bad.
Yeah, and that number can go up to as high as 1.35, depending on the property and the deal. But we clearly have a source of funding that's still available in the SBA that hasn't dried up. And we're keeping our fingers crossed that it won't. Once you get out of the SBA arena, though, it's a different game. Loans are very difficult to get.
Paul, that's maybe where Bruce was asking about the more dramatic change for investors in the market, right?
Right.
Well, not just investors, but owners. But, I mean, that market changed. And about the best you're going to get is about 65% loan-to-value, and they're going to calculate the income stream very cautiously. So you're only going to get about 86% of the income income stream allocatable to your payment.
Now, you had discussed over lunch one time the idea of mezzanine financing. Has that increased in cost? And please describe what that is again for me.
Well, mezzanine financing used to be anything that was above the 75% loan-to-value range. It's now anything above the 60% loan-to-value range.
Okay.
If you can get it, if your underlying lender will allow it, which is also become more problematic, you're going to pay substantially for it, and it's going to be, it'll be in the 14 to 15% and up range.
And is that typical, what's the typical length in time in years for that financing?
You know, it's typically going to be a shorter term financing, 3 to 5 years.
Now, what about the first? Does that usually...
The first definitely will be a longer term. You can get 10-year financing on a first.
It doesn't amortize, though, does it?
It can. Most of them like to see 25-year amortizations.
Due in 10. Okay.
They like to get risk, as much risk out of the equation as they can. And especially right now, where risk is now, you know, being looked at seriously again.
Is that how cap rate changes?
Definitely it's affecting cap rates. One of the things, interestingly, about cap rates that has held up somewhat well over the last 24 months is if it's very good real estate, if it tends to be infill, if it tends to be, current state-of-the-art construction for whatever type, if it's got a good tenant in it, the cap rates have held low, and the reason for that is there's not much faith in alternative yields out there. So a pension investor can come in and be pretty happy with, with maybe a 6-cap deal because he feels that he's got inflation protection, and he's got, and he's got a decent piece of real estate that's better yields than he may be seeing other places, But what's happened in the marketplace is that there's a bright line between the all-cash buyers and the leverage buyers. And the all-cash buyers that are fiduciaries or that are looking for that kind of property only go to first-class properties. The other guys are all scrambling, and they got to go get the debt, and the debt's pushed those cap rates up substantially. And so we've seen cap rates go up about 25%. They're probably going to go up another 10% over the next year. So that we started maybe in 07 or late 06, we were at 6 caps, and that number's now closing in on an 8 cap and could be an 8.5 cap by the middle of next year.
Mm-hmm. If an asset goes from a 6 cap to an 8.5 cap, what percentage of the value just disappeared?
Well, about the same percentage.
So about 25% or so?
Yeah.
Okay.
And what it's really decimated, of course, is any new development business. You cannot make a transaction work in a development arena with land prices that are not reacting or that don't react as quickly, or construction prices that don't react as quickly, or rents that are at best holding steady. You can make no new development business work because without the leverage, there's just no commensurate cash and cash return.
We've noticed the same thing in the residential. We have neighborhoods that we're selling for $1.4 million going for $650, mm-hmm. and they have lots for sale in there for $500.
Yeah, and they're not really for sale.
Right.
Apparently
right.
not. At least not seriously, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I there's definitely a difference between those that are sellers and those that would like to be.
There's about $100 billion of commercial financing that comes due next year. So do you see that being a problem for people that have to refi in this environment?
I think that number's low.
Okay.
And the reason I say that is I think that number would basically be premised on maybe individual loans on individual buildings. Don't forget there's organizations out there with large lines of credit that were made based on a valuation that's going to be 25% lower in a year, and that money's also going to come due either through time or loan covenants, and that's going to be an even bigger number.
Now, if you have a commercial building, is it similar to having a home equity line?
Yes.
Okay. So you could think you have a $2 million credit line and somebody can give you send you a piece of mail and say you're now at $1 million.
Yeah, or worse, they'll send you a piece of mail that says that you've got $5 million of loan against the property. We made that when the property was worth $7.5-8 million. We now think it's worth $6 million. Come up with another $1 million. We're making the margin call.
That would be a problem, perhaps.
Yeah.
The pension funds, do they typically buy real estate free and clear?
Yes, most of them, a lot of them are not leveraged.
Okay. So at least they own something.
Yeah, they tend to be in it for a longer haul. They tend to hold out tighter on rents. They don't react as quickly.
Okay. And what would be the makeup of a REIT, and how would they differ from a pension fund?
Well, a REIT depends on the model. There's a couple of different models. There's the ones that are suffering the most are the ones that had the funds from operations type of model, where they were developing product and then selling it once upon completion and lease up to the fund itself. And so without development, if that was a big part of their revenue source, their revenues have dropped. And REITs do lever. Most of them are conservatively levered, but, you know, a loan that was 50% loan to value 2 years ago was super conservative, and a year from now it may be a 70% or 65% loan to value. It won't be as conservative. And those were some of the things I was saying, maybe some of the hidden commercial property financings that may show up, as those financings break the covenant or come due, they're going to be a problem.
The stock values of REITs have probably gone through the floor. Does that affect their ability to borrow money from lenders?
Yes.
Okay, so if they had financing come due, if they were part of the group that refied, they might have a very difficult time getting new loans?
Yes.
If that happens, do they just decide to liquidate some real estate to gain liquidity? Is that the cycle?
Yes.
Okay. That's not.
And what they would liquidate first would be land, if they could get rid of it. But, you know, let's face it, anybody that's in a position of liquidation is going to do what they got to do to raise what capital they need.
Okay. The commercial world usually has a word attached to it, personal liability. Was that still in place at the peak of the market?
No, actually, it wasn't. Actually, at the end of the day, non-recourse as we would call it, was pretty much in play, with the exception of construction loans or A&D type loans, which, you know, which have recourse. But there were a lot of non-recourse or what they called covenant light loans being made at the end of the day.
Covenant light, I like that.
Yeah.
Now,
well,
what
the lenders don't anymore, but they liked it then.
Now, is that changed? Is that now there's recourse?
Oh yeah, yeah. It's very, if you can get non-recourse, it's very low loan to value. In other words, you can. We did a deal. We closed it right before that last meltdown with AIG. Interesting transaction in that it was two industrial buildings, leased investments. We sold them. The borrower had a loan, and he was complaining to me that he's been borrowing from them for 20 years from the lender, big lender, name brand lender, and that he couldn't get much more than a 40% non-recourse piece.
Mm.
And the deal was tricky because there was an environmental insurance policy that covered a piece of the property that wasn't being sold. We agreed to bifurcate it and sell and assign part of that policy. And at the end of the day, we got in a fight because the lender or the insurer came back and said, well, we'll carve it in half, but we're going to reduce coverage unless you want new coverage. And environmental policies are paid all up front cash. It was $120,000. We settled out. The deal closed Friday. On Monday, AIG filed their problem, and AIG was the underlying insurer on the environmental policy.
Wow. We only have a couple more minutes in this segment. Insurance companies, are they big players somehow in the financing of commercial real estate?
They are, but they've pulled way back.
Okay, so, but they could have risk. I guess that's what I'm asking.
Yeah, in fact, they do have risk, and they've pulled way back on their availability of funds.
Okay. How about vacancies in the space that that you're involved in?
Vacancies are not totally out of control, but we're seeing them increase. The West End is stronger than the East End. Eric, you might drop some specific numbers.
Yeah, and in fact, the one thing you might think about, there's a couple of words that get tossed around. One is vacancy.
And yes.
We track it for buildings that are, you know, physically vacant, meaning there's no tenant in there. And then we also track what we call availability rate. Those are buildings that are on the market but could be occupied. What we're seeing a lot of right now is an increase in sublease space. Companies that took space and maybe they leased 200,000 to 400,000 square feet, and right now they only need half of that space.
I see.
So they've got the other half of their building on the market. So the true, say, vacancy number may hover around the 6% range right now for the West End, but the availability rate is approaching 12%.
Okay. All right. And when we get to our next segment, I'm going to ask a little bit about the historical picture, how we compare this downturn to other downturns and what you expect to see as far as lender-owned commercial buildings. So for right now, Paul and Eric, thank you very much for joining us, and we will hit it again on the next segment.
All right, Bruce. Thank you for thinking of us.
You bet.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.